Want to say a word about the assignments. Every week there are several come to me and give me their paper that they forgot to turn in. And then I get them mixed up with my other papers, and sometimes it's a week or two before I find them. I give you proper credit for it, but I think it would be simpler if you always turned them in upstairs, if you put them in the box upstairs. And I'd like to ask this. They are due at noon on Friday. Now, if you forget to get them in, if you're not here Fridays, that's perfectly all right. But in that case, please just mark on the paper, do not come on Friday. In that case, turn it in Monday up there. It'll be perfectly all right. But if you have done it before the time it was due and you forgot it, just mark on the top, done on time, and put it in up there. Just mark that. Otherwise, either leave it blank or mark late on it. But I think perhaps it'll be simpler to just put them up there for now. I'll probably get to them a little quicker than I do this way when I get them mixed in with a lot of other things that I bring with me. Now, these papers, as you see, are not very much help for grading. They are not, that's not their purpose. Of course, if your mark at the end is between two marks, and I find your papers have regularly been late, have often been late, or have not been up to quality, it could make the difference between the two marks. But the purpose of these papers is not primarily to grade you on your work, it's to prepare you for the lecture. It's to have you have an idea of some of the problems that we're going to meet. Now, that's not always the case. There may be some cases where it's different. But as a rule, that is the purpose, is to prepare you for the lecture so that you will be better able to get the value of it. And in addition to that, as I look them over on Friday, it gives me an idea what you have easily gotten from the passage that I don't need to take much time on, or where you have found it difficult to get it, and therefore I need to spend a little more time explaining it than otherwise would be the case. So they are a real help to me in preparing the lecture, and they should be a real help to you in understanding the lecture. Now, in this course, as you know, we are studying two passages of Isaiah, two passages that are parallel. They are each of them a definite unit. Chapter 7 to 12 is sharply distinguished from what follows, and is lightly distinguished, but definitely distinguished from what precedes. Chapters 28 to 35 are rather sharply separated from what precede and also from what follows. So in each of these two cases, it is quite clear that we have a definite division. Now, in the ancient Hebrew and in the ancient Greek, they did not usually put in divisions. They do not have quotation marks. They don't have exclamation points. There are many cases where they have nothing corresponding to a question mark. And so there is much more that we have to decide from context than there is with our modern type of typography. And that means that often, if we don't have an understanding of a whole passage, we are apt to mistranslate or misinterpret a certain part of the passage. The King James Version is very difficult when you get to difficult passages of the Old Testament for most people today, because so many words have changed their meaning. And so many manners of saying things are different today from what they were in those days. But in addition to that, while on the whole it was a very excellent translation for the language of 300 years ago, a very excellent translation, and there are many points at which I believe their interpretation is better than the interpretation of most of the recent translators. Yet, in some rather difficult passages, such as chapters 28 and 29, it is quite clear to me that the King James Revisers did not study into the passage enough to see what it was really about. And therefore, they translated sort of word for word, rather than in the light of context to present the idea that those words were supposed to present. And I believe that you found it much easier to get the sense of chapter 28 if you used a modern version than if you used the King James Version. But there are two or three cases where the King James, unfortunately, has either mistranslated or has translated in what I would call a rather sloppy manner due to their not having studied the passage as a whole. Now, as we are have noticed, we have the same situation at the beginning of both of these long passages. Both section from 7 to 12 and from 28 to 35 start with Ahaz, the man who was supposed to be David's successor, head of the people of God, but who was not interested in God's will. A man who was a scorner, a man who was a scoffer, a man who was seeking by his own what he thought was clever reasoning to figure how he could advance himself and advance his country. And the Lord said, if you would trust me, this being my people, you being the descendant of David who is the head of my people, if you would trust me, I would see you safely through it. Now, your clever scheme is not going to profit you at all. You'll be worse off as a result than before. The result of it, instead of simply delivering you from Israel and from Judah, is going to be to have your land overrun by the Assyrians several times, reaching a great climax in the coming of Sennacherib. But nevertheless, he says, you're still my people. Not to Ahaz, to the people. You're still my people, and Sennacherib, the Assyrians, are not going to be able to take Jerusalem. I'm going to protect it. The land will remain independent way into the future, a whole century and more beyond the time of Sennacherib. It even would outlive the Assyrian Empire. And the conquest would not be by the Assyrians at all, but by their successors, the Babylonians. And as Isaiah gives these messages, he occasionally looks way forward beyond them into God and gets glimpses of God's great plan going far beyond the immediate situations. And, of course, we are very interested in those glimpses when we get there. Now, look then at chapter 28, and I asked all of you to look particularly at one verse. I asked you, what is the subject of the verb for today? And in the King James, that verse simply says, in verse 7, but they also have erred. And of course that gives you the idea that the also has to do with the erring. And who were the they? Is he talking about the same people he talked of before or some different people? The New International Version says, and these also stagger from wine. And the introduction of the these suggests that there is a change of subject. Those of you who have already had some Hebrew know that in Hebrew, you never see a verb that simply means go. The verb means he goes, or he went, or he will go, or they went, or go you one person, or go you plural men, or go you women. All that is included in the verb. And ordinarily, if you say they stagger, it would just be the verb. But in the Hebrew here, your word also comes at the very beginning of the verse. I think it would be better if instead of saying these also stagger, which sounds as if the also goes with the stagger, it would be also these stagger. Or these two stagger. I think if we say two, it puts it with the word before rather than with the word after. In our best English, probably two would be better. But also these. It is wagam ele. The subject is expressed here in the Hebrew. There is a definite change. It is not simply they, it is these. And I believe most of your modern translations, probably all of them, would bring out that it is these. And there is a contrast with what precedes. Now, studying the chapter, one finds out what the situation is. In chapter 7, you're told the situation. You're given the background. Here you have to go through the chapter and find various indications to tell you of the background. And of course, you have the material in Kings, and you have the material at the beginning of 7 showing you some detail about the background. And so after we do that, we are justified in saying this is the same situation in general, but slightly different. In chapter 7, Isaiah, in order to get Ahaz's attention, had to go out to the place where Ahaz was directing the preparation of the protective armament to protect them from the expected invasion by the Syrians and the Ephraimites. He had to go out there to get him to listen. Now, in this case, he is not talking to Ahaz. Ahaz is probably not present. But this is undoubtedly a banquet. A banquet put on by the nobles, put on by Ahaz's leading men. And these nobles of Judah are having this banquet in order to celebrate the fact that an arrangement with Assyria has been made. Assyria is going to protect them. They will not have to fear being conquered by Israel and by Syria. And so in that situation, where they're having this great banquet of celebration, and how many people there knew what the banquet was about, we don't know. But at least the leaders in the banquet knew. And here they're having this big banquet, and Isaiah comes in. And you might say, well, where's your ticket? What right do you have to come in? Well, it may well be that it was more or less open. There had been a fairly general invitation given. A good many people were in there, and some of them were people who thought highly of Isaiah, and they couldn't just say, look at here, you're not invited, you don't belong here. Anyway, a prophet in those days had certain privileges. He could speak out on various occasions, and people were expected to listen. And so Isaiah steps into the banquet, and he says something that pleases them greatly. They are going to be delivered from Ephraim's attack because the Assyrians are coming. If only they can hold off Ephraim long enough, not be overrun by them before the Assyrians get there. And so here he says, woe to that wreath, the pride of Ephraim's drunkards. And these fellows sitting at their table and enjoying their sumptuous meal, are happy to be reminded that they don't need to worry about Ephraim. Ephraim is coming. They're going to try to protect themselves from Ephraim. Isaiah says, woe to Ephraim. Well, that's great. That makes everybody feel happy. So nobody feels like throwing Isaiah out. They're interested to listen. Woe to the wreath, the pride of Ephraim's drunkards. Oh, yeah, those awful drunkards up there. That's not saying what we are. But they are awful drunkards up there. We're glad to hear them rebuked. To the fading flower, his glorious beauty set on the head of a fertile valley. To that city, the pride of those laid low by wine. Some of these fellows here are barely able to stand up, but still they can look down on those drunkards up there, laid down by wine. See, the Lord has one who's powerful and strong like a hailstone and a destructive wind, like a driving rain and a flooding downpour. What is this? Like a hailstorm and a destructive wind, like a driving rain and a flooding downpour. Is this describing the coming of the Assyrian army that's just going to sweep over Ephraim and destroy it? Well, that's grand to know it's going to happen, isn't it? He will throw it forcefully to the ground, that wreath, the pride of Ephraim's drunkards. He repeatedly talks about these drunkards of Ephraim. And they all say, oh my, those awful drunkards of Ephraim. That will be trampled underfoot, that fading flower, his glorious beauty set on the head of a fertile valley, will be like a fig right before harvest. As soon as someone sees it and takes it in his hand, he swallows it. A figurative expression, somebody going into a vineyard and seeing just one fig that's really ripe, and he hasn't had any figs since the last year's season. And he grabs it off the tree and he swallows it down hurriedly. Just like that, Ephraim is just going to be overcome. My, that's wonderful, isn't it? And then we have a break. Isaiah, they've been very happy to hear him giving his denunciation of Ephraim, that they are so afraid we'll conquer them before the Assyrians get there. But here he turns his attention. He says, in that day, I think in present idiom, it better to say, there will be a day when. There will be a day when the Lord Almighty will be a glorious crown, a beautiful wreath for the remnant of his people. Here, this is this beautiful wreath. Samaria was a city at that time many times as big as Jerusalem. It was up on a much higher hill than Jerusalem, had a much greater outlook. It seemed to be far ahead of Jerusalem. Actually, it was the capital of a country twice as big as that over which Jerusalem was capital at that time. And he says, here is this wreath that is going to be wiped out. It's going to be completely disappear. But he says, the day is coming when the Lord Almighty will be a glorious crown, a beautiful wreath for the remnant of his people. There are going to be some left. There are going to be people left from the northern kingdom. People who are true believers. People who may have to go through captivity and through misery, but whom God is going to lead and bring out safely. For the remnant of his people, he will be a beautiful wreath. He will be a spirit of justice to him who sits in judgment, a source of strength to those who turn back the battle at the gate. And so these two verses, these banqueters have sort of put up with. They said, well, that was great what he said to encourage the people to fight against Ephraim, because they believe God's going to protect us and we're going to win out and we won't be overcome by them. That's helpful. Fine. But he, of course, now he's got some pious expressions. You can expect that from the prophet. We won't worry too much about it. But then in verse 7, he says, and these also stagger from wine and reel from strong drink. You've been talking about the drunkards of Ephraim, and we're all saying, yes, yes, these are awful the way they are. He says, look at these folks. He says, they're just as bad. Well, they don't like that particular. But he's already gotten their attention. He's gotten their interest. There are many lessons intact in the scripture. There are times when somebody goes up to a man and shakes his fist in his face and says, you old sinner, it's time you turn to the Lord and repent. And the Lord uses it to bring him to him. But in most cases, the Lord uses more tactful methods. In most cases, he wants us to get attention, get interest, and then we're in a position to give the message. Exactly. Yes. Yes. These also. I think he pointed. These also. And you see that Hebrew word, these, is put in there, which ordinarily you wouldn't even have a subject. And when the King James just says they also, it doesn't get the thought at all. Mr. Kluge?
The final six specifically says, am I faithful to the Lord?
I think 5 and 6 are a general expression of God's mercy, with perhaps thinking to quite an extent of the remnant of the northern kingdom, but some of the people here may think, well, Israel's gone, we're the remnant. Some of them may think they all are the remnant. That's great. Look the position we're in when they're gone. We're the remnant God's going to bless. But I think both ideas were in it. People could take it either way they wanted, but now he says, but these, and he turns his attention right directly to the people in front of him. And he says, these also are staggering. Priests and prophets stagger from strong drink and are befuddled with wine. They reel from strong drink. They stagger from when seeing visions. They stumble when rendering decisions. And of course, the leaders think, now that's where he's wrong. He says, we stumble when we make decision. We made a mighty good decision making this agreement with Assyria. They're going to destroy Ephraim and Aram. And make us safe. We made a good decision. He says, they stumble when rendering decisions. And he says, all the tables are covered with vomit and there's not a spot without filth. Now that's a pretty strong statement. And they They don't like that. And the next verse, verse 9 in the NIV, has a quotation mark at the beginning of it. There are, of course, no quotation marks in the King James Version. There are no quotation marks in the Hebrew. But from the sense of the passage, it is very clear that what follows, who is it he is trying to teach, is somebody else talking about Isaiah. Who does Isaiah think he's trying to teach, talking to us this way? Who's he talking to? To whom is he explaining the message? Does he think we're children weaned from their milk, those just taken from the breast? For it is. And then the next words are hard to translate into English precisely, though the general thought of them is very clear. The King James translates them in verse 10. Precept is upon, must be, it says upon precept. That must be is in italics and should not be there. For precept is on precept, precept on precept, line on line, line on line, here a little, there a little. NIV has it a little differently, but the same idea. They say, for it is do and do, rule on rule, rule on rule, a little here, a little there. Talking to us like little children, repeating the same thing over and over. You get it now, this and this and this. Isaiah's always coming with all these talks. You trust in God, you follow him. You remember the old days, the way God did in the past. That's just baby talk. We don't want that kind of stuff. What's he trying to do? Well, they're mumbling to each other now. And this is what they're saying. And Isaiah answers them in verse 11. You see, that is not made clear in the King James. It says, for with stammering lips and another tongue will he speak to this people. That it ties it to what precedes where it doesn't belong, and it starts with for, while the preposition ki could just as well be translated but. The NIV is a little free here, but I think expresses the idea pretty well. Very well then. With foreign lips and strange tongues, God will speak to this people. What does that mean? You don't want to take God's this, believe this, do this, his simple teaching of the Bible. You think it's treating you like children to treat you that way. Well, he says, God will speak to you with foreign lips and strange tongues. This people to whom he said, this is the resting place. Let the weary rest. And this is the place of repose. But they would not listen. So then the word of the Lord to them will become. And then he repeats their words. Do and do, rule on rule, rule on rule. A little here, a little there. So that they will go and fall backward, be injured and snared and captured. You say we're trying to give you baby talk. We're trying to give you these little simple pious things that you think are a lot of nonsense. You won't listen to this. Well, God will speak to you with foreign lips and a strange tongue. It'll sound to you sort of like baby talk when you hear these Assyrian soldiers calling to one another to what they're to do and rushing through your houses and grabbing your property and taking your children away captive. The word of the Lord, if you won't listen to what you say is the baby talk of the pious presentation of God's will, God will speak to you in a way that will seem to you like baby talk. He will speak to you with another tongue, with other lips, in what will sound to you like gibberish. But God will speak to you in that way. Now, of course, that meant the Assyrian army coming through, the Assyrian soldiers. They might not be able to grasp that as yet. But that is certainly in the light of context is what it is. And as you go on further in the chapter, it becomes quite clear. Maybe we could open that door a little bit. It is getting pretty hot here, don't you think? Or at least I'm getting hot. Thank you. So then he says this will happen, so they will go and fall backward, be injured and shared and captured. Therefore, now he speaks quite directly to them. Therefore, hear the word of the Lord, you scoffers who rule this people in Jerusalem. You boast, we have entered into a covenant with death. With the grave, we've made an agreement. When an overwhelming scourge sweeps by, it cannot touch us. What do they mean by that? You boast, we've entered into a covenant with death. With hell, we've made an agreement. When the overwhelming scourge sweeps by, it won't touch us. In other words, you have your clever idea that here is this aggressive Assyrian force that's threatening to overrun everything. We're getting on their side. We're getting Assyria to help us. And when Assyria overruns Aram and overruns Israel, it won't hurt us. They may go on and attack somebody the other side of us, but they won't bother us. We're their allies. We'll be perfectly safe. We've made a covenant with death. We've made an agreement with hell. And that way we're going to fight fire with fire. We've worked our clever scheme, our plan that's going to put us on the side of the terrible aggressors and bring us safely through it. We've made a lie our refuge and falsehood our hiding place. But he says, so this is what the sovereign Lord says. What does God say in answer to that? What did God say to Ahaz in the first place when Isaiah went out? He said, trust in the Lord. The Lord can deliver you. Here's what the sovereign Lord says. See, I lay a stone in Zion, a tested stone, a precious cornerstone for a sure foundation. The one who trusts will never be dismayed. Now that word dismayed here could also be translated, shall not make haste. Both meanings are involved in the situation, which is the correct interpretation of the word. We can't tell. It's like many words in English which have two possibilities because two different words have fallen together in them. Like if I say to you, if I hold up a little pocket testament and I say this book is light and it's a black cover, you say that's not light, that's dark. And if I hold up to you a great big wedding Bible, great big heavy one that has white covers, and I say this book is light, you say it's not light, it's heavy. Well, two old English words that were completely different have fallen together into our one word light. And usually we can tell from the context what the meaning is, but there are cases where we can't. And in this case, we can't tell whether it should be our dismayed or whether it will never be dismayed or will never make haste, but both are true. The one who trusts in the Lord need never be dismayed because he knows that all things are in accordance with God's will. And that if he's truly following the Lord, God works all things for his good. He need not be dismayed and he need not make haste. There's a difference between doing things rapidly and making haste. When you make haste, you get all bothered and fussed and get things mixed up and probably will do them wrong. You never need to get in that situation if you're truly trusting in the Lord. Well, now, in this verse, then, Isaiah is looking at the immediate situation, but he is giving a general principle. And he gives the general principle in words which can very specifically look forward to what God is going to do when he is going to provide a precious cornerstone for a sure foundation, a stone in Zion. So there is definitely a looking forward to the coming of Christ. But that's not the immediate significance. It is a general principle which finds its full application in the coming of Christ. Yes, Mr. Allen?
Does the New Testament, where the prophecy is quoted, have to help us understand how that's
true?
In Romans 9, 33, and you who believe in him will not be disappointed?
Will not be disappointed. We'd have to look at the precise Greek and the precise Hebrew and see. And there's a problem there in using a New Testament quotation to decide on the precise reading of an Old Testament passage. There's always this problem. The New Testament usually quotes from the common translation. And consequently, but if the point that the New Testament is trying to bring out is not brought out in the common translation, it will give you a direct translation from the Hebrew to bring out that point. So if the New Testament quotation is dealing with the precise point under consideration, then you can say definitely that's the way the Old Testament should be translated. That's the correct original text, like a virgin shall bring forth. That, but if the point that is being brought out is clearly brought out and there's a word that isn't closely related to that, that is a little different from the way we might translate the Old Testament passage. It may be that it is simply quoting from the common translation. Now you and I will do the same thing. We quote a verse to bring out a point. And there may be some part of the verse that isn't quite as precise a translation as we might wish, but we don't spend time discussing that part of the verse. So I would say you'd have to see how vital it is to the immediate significance. And of course, both are true. He will not be dismayed. He will not make haste. They're two different ideas. Now, be disappointed is more like be dismayed. I believe it fits more in that category. But I don't have the precise Greek word in mind, and I would not speak offhand on it, even if I did. That's the New Testament relation to this now. So we have here he looks way ahead, but he's looking ahead in its relation to the present situation. He says, you must trust in God and in the stone that God will set in place, the cornerstone of God's work. You must trust in him, he says, and you will never be dismayed or you never need make haste. I will make justice the measuring line and righteousness the plumb line. Hail will sweep away your refuge, the lie, and water will overflow your hiding place. You think you're safe because of this alliance with Assyria. You think Assyria is going to deliver you from Aram and from Israel, and you don't need to worry about it because you're on Assyria's side. Well, you'll find out that doesn't do you any good. The Assyrians will take everything in their way, and they will overrun the whole land, and eventually they'll be ready to take Jerusalem itself. And I'm going to protect you through that, the Lord says. I'm going to give you a great protection, but it won't be any of your doing. It will be by God's miraculous way that he will keep the Assyrian from destroying even Jerusalem. And it makes it very clear as he goes on. He says, hail will sweep away your refuge of lies. Water will overflow your hiding place. Your covenant with death will be annulled. That is their covenant with the Assyrian that is bringing death to so many countries that you think by getting on their side you're going to be safe. It's not going to work that way at all. I remember Dr. Chisholm, who was a very fine missionary in Korea before the beginning of the World War. And in Korea there, the Japanese were making people go to the shrine and worship the Japanese ancestors. And many of the missionaries said, well, they said, it's just a form. We go and we bow to the Japanese shrine, but it's just a form. It's a patriotic thing that the Japanese are insisting that we do here. And if we submit to it, we can carry on our missionary work unhindered. And it's worth just making this compromise. But Dr. Chisholm was one of those who said, no, he said, this is idolatry. He said, we cannot present to these Koreans the necessity of believing in God and trusting Christ and trusting him alone and then go and worship to a Japanese shrine. And so he refused to do it. And there were a number of missionaries like that who did, and these missionaries were hampered. Some of them were put in prison. they had quite a bit of persecution from the Japanese occupying authorities there at the time. But then the time came when the war between the United States and Japan was imminent, and the missionaries all had to leave and come home, or else those who didn't were interned for the whole course of the war. And Dr. Chisholm got on the boat, and there was another missionary on the boat, one who had compromised with the Japanese authorities and gone to the shrine and had given all these excuses that he would be free to preach and present the word without interference if he went through this form of bowing at the heathen shrine. And Dr. Chisholm said the boat went from Korea to Japan and stopped there and was thoroughly examined by the Japanese and then allowed to proceed. And he said the Japanese authority came on. He had the records of all these missionaries, and he said, William Chisholm. And Mr. Chisholm came forward, and he said, where's your baggage? And he glanced at it and marked it and let him go. And then he said this other missionary was called forward, who felt that he, having gone to the shrines and compromised this way, the Japanese would realize he was their friend, make him no trouble whatever. He had made Dr. Chisholm a little trouble there, which was a bit embarrassing. But this other man, they went through everything he had. They took every bit of material he had. They spread it out on the decks. They examined it very thoroughly. And the man was so embarrassed and so humiliated by it. He said the Japanese could understand a man standing for what he believed, even at the cost of losing something by it. But when the man who compromised, they were willing to take advantage of his compromise, but when it came to his leaving, they didn't trust him. And they were going to go through everything that he had before they were sure it was safe to let him go on. And as he says here, the water will overflow your hiding place, your covenant with death will be annulled. And in the end, that kind of compromise does not help one to advance the Lord's work. And how much more does it fail to help one to advance such objectives as these people had? Your agreement with hell will not stand. When the overwhelming scourge sweeps by, you will be beaten down by it. As often as it comes, it will carry you away. Morning after morning, by day and by night, it will sweep through. The understanding of this message will bring sheer terror. And so he points forward to the series of Assyrian incursions through their land that they were to suffer as a result of Ahaz's scheme instead of trusting God. Yes, Mr. Phil?
Verse 17, I will make justice of Assyrian land, righteousness of long life.
Yes.
What does it mean?
It means that they will not profit by their underhanded scheme, that everything will be brought out in the light of God's justice, and they will suffer from it much worse than they would if they hadn't made this deal with Assyria. Mr. Allen?
I'm interested in the fact that when things are passed like this, that a lot of this does it war, you know,
yes. Yes, I would say that it would. There is an area in which it is not always easy to draw absolutely sharp lines, but it is an area in which this definitely does apply. And I would say it is better to draw too sharp a line than to make a compromising line. But that there is a right point to find in relation to it. And the one who thinks that he can work with and deal with those who are destroying the work of God and thereby get a chance to advance the gospel is usually going to find it doesn't work out. It does not receive God's favor to do that. Yes, I believe there's a great deal in this chapter that has much application to us in our lives and in our Christian work. And so he says, when the overwhelming scourge comes through, he says, you will be beaten down by it. But then verse 20, What would verse 20 mean if you don't have the context and the situation in mind? The bed is too short to stretch out on. The blanket too narrow to wrap around you. What he means, this scheme of yours that you think is going to protect you isn't sufficient. It's not satisfactory. The bed's too short to stretch out on. The blanket's too narrow to wrap yourself in. It is a figurative expression, of course, but in the context, the meaning is absolutely clear. That your human schemes that disregard the Lord's will, and that disregard the clear teaching of His Word, they will not work in the end. They will not give you a bed that's long enough to stretch on, a blanket that's wide enough to wrap yourself in. The Lord will rise up as He did at Mount Perazim. He will rouse Himself as at the Valley of Gibeon. This is referring to the cases where God used Joshua's army in order to completely defeat the Canaanites, and where the Lord miraculously interfered in order to allow them to accomplish far more than would have been expected. He says the Lord is going to use the Assyrian for His purposes. You are going to find that this that you think is going to stop at your border won't stop there. As it said in chapter 7, it will sweep on through into Judah. Now stop your mocking or your chains will become heavier. The Lord Almighty has told me of the destruction decreed against the whole land. Now these 22 verses give us the situation rather precisely. And we see him in the banquet hall there speaking to the people. Now whether they let him get this far or whether they rose up and drove him out and he can finish the talk to those who were rather impressed and followed him, I would think it likely that he was able to get this far there. But he goes on talking about the general situation clear on to the end of 35. And I would guess that most of that is given to a group of men who were interested in hearing the word of the Lord as Isaiah gave it. We have direct denunciation here. We have some more direct denunciation as we go on through. So in the group to which he spoke, whether it was the whole banquet hall or whether it was a group that came out of it or whether it was a group he continued talking to the next day, there were those who were representative of the people as a whole, those who represented the scoffers and the unbelievers and were interested in what he had to say, but there also were the true followers of God. Yes? Yes. I would say that most particularly you get it from verse 7 and 8, where he turns his, after criticizing the drunkards of Ephraim, he turns his attention to these people right here and says, these people also are staggering by from wine and strong drink. Every table is full of vomit. Why mention a table unless he's in a place where there are tables? Yes?
Are we to assume that Isaiah remembered what he had said at the banquet and he went home and wrote about it? Or was there someone at the banquet that was recording his words? Or how are we to understand the preservation of his words?
We don't know. Either one would be possible. In those days when there wasn't as much writing as there is today, people had much better memories than they have today. Although even today, there are people who've memorized the whole New Testament. There are many Mohammedans who've memorized the whole Quran. And my memory was far better 50 years ago than it is now. I remember once when I was in college, when I was talking with a fellow and he happened to refer to something that happened 6 months before, and I remembered everything he'd said and everything I'd said. I couldn't do that now, I don't believe. But I mean, memories vary. It's altogether possible that Isaiah wrote it down. It's also possible that he had a friend there who wrote it down as he gave it. We just don't know. But it was almost certainly written down soon afterward, I would think. So this next part of the chapter, I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on. if you read it without the early part in mind, you sort of wonder, what on earth is he talking about? But with the early part in mind, you can see a figurative presentation of a number of great spiritual truths. He is saying God works in logical, reasonable ways. Listen, hear my voice. Pay attention, hear what I say. When a farmer plows for planting, does he keep on plowing all the time? Does he keep on all the time breaking up and harrowing the soil? When he's leveled the surface, then he sows caraway or scatters cumin. He plants wheat in a particular place, barley in its plot, spelt in its place. His God instructs him and teaches him the right way. He is saying God has his purpose in relation to different situations. And we find this brought out very clearly in the fact that Isaiah predicted God would protect Jerusalem and Jeremiah predicted that God would destroy Jerusalem. They had a different situation, but all part of God's great plan. And God's plan is orderly. God's plan is systematic. You might say that life is like a rug, say an oriental rug, of which you look at the bottom part, and you see threads here and there, and you don't see any pattern. There's no clear picture. You see the front of it, and there's a beautiful picture, but you look at the back of it, and you see the wrong side of it, and you don't see the picture. And we look at it that way. But someday we'll see the whole picture, and we'll see that God has worked in our lives in logical, reasonable fashion, and that God has a purpose in it all. And so, 27, caraway is not threshed with a sledge, nor is a cart wheel ruled over cumin. Caraway is beaten out with a rod and cumin with a stick. God deals with you in proportion to your situation and to your need and to your character. And you can trust in him. Grain must be ground to make bread, so one doesn't go on threshing it forever. He drive the wheels of his threshing cart over it, but his horses don't grind it. He uses different methods. He uses the method that pertains to the result he wants to bring. And we don't know, each of us, exactly the full result that God wants to bring in our lives. But we know that God knows what is suited to bring the qualities into us that he wants us to have, to bring the situations into our life that he wants us to have. And God works in mysterious ways in the lives of all of us. But they are ways that are logical. I detest that phrase, unconditional election. I certainly believe that God has chosen those who are to be saved. But when you say unconditional, it sounds as if he just reaches his hand in a hat and picks out a few names. And that is certainly not true. That is, of course, is not what the term is supposed to mean, but the term was selected in order to make an acrostic, and it was a poor selection. Because God has purposes in all that he does. There are conditions involved in it. He uses that which will accomplish the results that he desires. He will, to that which needs the hard beating, that's what he'll use. But to that which would be broken by it, instead of being built up by it, he uses more gentle methods. And so this passage here about the farmer is a passage which applied to the people in Israel, God's treatment of the wicked and God's treatment of the true believers, God's treatment of them in different situations, and which applies to each of our lives too. So a passage which, as I say, it means nothing, I think, when you first read it. But reading it carefully in the light of what it means, it's all figurative, but they're very important figures that can apply to the way that God deals with each one of us. And at the beginning of chapter 29, I'm not sure there should be a big break there. There is a little break there. He says, Woe to you, Ariel, the city where David settled. Now, where did David settle? David was born in Bethlehem, but David conquered Jerusalem and made it his capital. And so Ariel here means Jerusalem. He is speaking here about Jerusalem. And the word Ariel could be interpreted in either of two ways. The word Ari could be a lion, or it could be a hearth. It could be the lion of God or the hearth of God. I don't know as Jerusalem is ever called this anywhere else. But it's perfectly obvious from the figure that he is here speaking about Jerusalem. And as to between these two possibilities, I believe that we have a pretty definite answer in chapter 31 that we looked at the other day, where we ended up, declares the Lord, whose fire is in Zion, whose furnace is in Jerusalem. This is the hearth of God. It is the place where God is going to work out some of his great mysterious purposes. And so for next time, I would like you to look over chapter 29. I don't think you need to take perhaps as much time on it as you did on 28. I think it's one of the most interesting chapters in this whole section when you get the key to its interpretation. And a part of the key, a substantial part of the key, is furnished by having looked at 28 already, but not all of the key. And so I wish you would give me for, I don't need to, I think, put it on the board this time, the lesson to be turned in by noon next Friday will be to make an outline, just a few main heads, of chapter 29. Note the divisions in it. What are the principal thoughts that are brought out in chapter 29? You might look, if you're using the King James Version, look at verse 5 and see if you think that verse 5, that the beginning of verse 5 has been well translated in the King James Version. It's quite different from most later versions. But that is the assignment for next time, and we'll continue there then next week.